Hello, everyone. Joshua Gilliland here, one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks. With me is my person most knowledgeable about Star Wars, Thomas Harper. And we're going to have a lot of fun discussing Clone Wars, the three episodes that in season seven we haven't talked about yet, which is A Distant Echo, On the Wings of Caradax, and Unfinished Business. And I hope I pronounced that correctly. Thomas, how's life in, the world that we live in and trying to avoid a virus treating you?
It's good. I think this podcast is a great example of social distancing all the way around. You and I have distanced ourselves with the entire country between us. And then everybody listening is distanced from us via their computer or radio. So this is what the health professionals are calling for, more Legal Geeks podcasts. Yep. That's the takeaway.
And yet we're still interacting together. So it's, yes, it's the nirvana for nerds of everyone stay home, stay away from others.
But we're and I will say on that note, Disney did the smart move of releasing a little bit of content early. Frozen 2 hit Disney Plus, and then Rise of Skywalker was released on digital a few days early. If only they would just drop the rest of the Clone Wars just tomorrow. Say, hey, we know you guys are having a tough time. Here's a whole boatload of Captain Rex and Ahsoka to fill your next few days. Be safe. That'd be amazing.
I think weekly's better because that way people have something to look forward to
in these dark times.
Yeah, that's each week it's that glimmer of hope that there will be more Star Wars in their near future. So, but like a teaser for Kenobi or at casting Andor could also work. So,
very true.
Yes. So let's talk about Echo. So this technically four episode arc is great. I really enjoyed it, and you know we do get a fair amount of Anakin when we get to Caradax, and also on to a lesser degree Unfinished Business. But you know it highlights how the clones can carry a story pretty much on their own. And which gives us hope for, you know, future Star Wars content that not everything has to have a Skywalker in it. And you can have non-Jedi stories where, you know, the Force is there. Well, when we find Echo, you know, the Techno Union has, like, either he was gravely injured at the Citadel, like we don't know what exactly happened there to the extent of his injuries, but they he's part droid now. There seems to be like the upper left shoulder, left arm, head, don't know how much internal organs survive, but there's very 30% of him left that's not droid at this point.
He's more machine now than man.
Yeah. Yeah, that looked like a serious boo-boo. And, you know, the right hand's gone and replaced with, you know, a data port. And he's kind of in a state of suspended animation being used to access his mind for strategies. And it's not clear... clearly the Separatists who were on the Citadel took what was left of him and either gave them to the Techno Union. There had to be a handoff of some kind. But when I saw him, I'm thinking, like, that's really messed up to do that to a POW. And could you walk us through what being a POW is and what rights they have and why experimenting on them is kind of verboten?
Yeah, this series of episodes is great for a number of reasons. You made the really good point about the clones carrying an episode on their own. And I think the strength of these four episodes is because of what the original series built Echo to be. Like, people really cared about his character. This is a clone that we saw since Rookies in season one. I think that was the third episode of the first season, fourth episode after the Malevolence arc. And so this is somebody that we've been with, and I don't want to see any clone in this situation, but what better character to put into this situation? Because obviously we don't know what happened to him. He's presumed dead. But then when we figure out this awful situation that the Techno Union has put him in, it really gives the audience somebody familiar to root for in this whole thing. But traditionally, what I love about this episode from a legal standpoint is sort of the deep dive that it takes into the area of prisoners of war. And they don't get into any kind of like cerebral discussions of it, but it's a good look at sort of the wounds of war that this sort of thing can have on a soldier, and also sort of the emotional pull that it causes. I mean, when they figure out that Echo is there, the initial reaction of the Bad Batch is like, well, you know, he's gone. Like we can't do anything for him. And Rex is adamant, like, no, we do not leave anybody behind. He's a POW here. We're going to figure this out and get to the bottom of it. And if he is here, we're going to rescue him. I think we've had very few POWs, I think, in really recent memory. And I say really recent, probably from like 2008 on. You saw a lot of that in the first Iraq War in some way, shape, or form during Operation Iraqi Freedom, like 03 to 05 or 06. But it's a concept that I think everybody's heard of, what a PO, like the term POW, people are familiar with it. It's not like a some really technical legal term that would make people scratch their heads, but it's a surprisingly deep legal concept. And it's something that POWs themselves have not always seen the same level of protections. I think I would go back like way back in history. Historically, POWs are just, you know, if you were a fighter for an army, you didn't have any protections if you got captured. I mean, in some cases, it was probably better that you died on the battlefield than get carted off as a prisoner. You had no rights, no status. You were effectively chattel or property. I mean, you were subject to summary execution, slavery, mutilation, castration, sacrifice to gods. I mean, you name, take your spin on the wheel of awful fortune, so to speak, and anything was fair game. And if you've heard of the term no quarter, whether like, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean movie or somewhere else, the term meaning, hey, we're not taking any prisoners, everybody gets executed after the battle, that was fair game as well. There were no rules against it for the longest time. You know, think of, I think the big example that comes to mind is a lot of like just the circumstances in the movie Gladiator, where, you know, you end up on the wrong side of the battle and that's your life, fighting for somebody else's pleasure. And things didn't get a whole lot better as history moved on. I mean, you fast forward from the Roman Empire to the American Revolution, and things aren't much better as a POW. I mean, the British had notorious prison ships that prisoners were kept on. The British Army or the Crown was notorious in the Revolutionary War for looking at American prisoners not as POWs deserving of protection and safeguarding, but as insurrectionists, sort of this subhuman class of fighters that had no business, legal or otherwise, being on the battlefield. And, you know, you had a lot of awful conditions. The Civil War is obviously notorious for it, you know, with certain camps like Andersonville being absolute horrors for that sort of thing. But what happened is, as the world exited each of these conflicts and it was clear how awful the conditions were for prisoners, there became sort of a slowly building movement to provide protections. And what you end up with in the wake of World War II, where you had a similarly awful experience for a lot of POWs, particularly in those held in Japanese custody, where you had, I think, I would say conservatively, 35% of POWs in Japanese custody died. Out of that came the Geneva Conventions, or the Geneva, specifically the Geneva Convention 3 of 1949. And that's where you get your baseline laws here. That's the entire framework that we use today. That's the foundation for how we as the United States treat prisoners of war. And I think the first question that we have to ask with Echo is whether he's actually a POW, right? That's a sort of a technical term. And it really depends on, you know, what kind of conflict we're in and what kind of person he is. And here, and I'll sort of turn this back over to you, Josh, because I'm like in lecture mode almost. But here, I think, without getting too far down into the weeds, the type of conflict that we have here, I think, qualifies folks for POW status. So in the real world, you have to have an international armed conflict in order for POW status to exist. Here in Star Wars and in the Clone Wars, you've got the Galactic Republic versus a bunch of sovereign systems that have dropped out. I think that's very different than like the Civil War, where states have seceded. Here you have, I would say, sovereign systems like Sereno and Raxus that have decided to go their own way in the galaxy. So think of those planets as countries almost. They happen to be countries that have banded together on two sides, but it's state versus state. And so because of that, the full Geneva Conventions would apply, and that includes Article 3 with POW status.
I agree.
You let me walk off the diving board and I took everybody with me.
No, it's, we need to discuss that.
Yeah.
The JAG officer. So yeah. Now, and you mentioned Andersonville. The Commandant of Andersonville was the only Confederate executed after the Civil War. And Walt Whitman, who served as a nurse, because he didn't want to be in the army, so his way of serving was to be a nurse. He was on hand in New York Harbor when the ship came in with the survivors from Andersonville. And his comment was, "I have no words to describe this." And so you had one of the most prolific poets of the 19th century say, I can't even describe this. And just to highlight the horror of what happened to those men. And if you look at photos of them and you shuffle them with survivors from Auschwitz, you can't tell them apart. That's how horrific it was. That, yeah, they just truly grotesque and evil, and would be a crime today.
And it took like, you know, 80-ish years after that, after those horrors, to truly get the sort of robust set of protections that we have today, which is just mind-bending.
I read a few years ago, Ship of Ghosts, about the crew of the USS Houston that was lost early days of World War II. And you know, the first half of the book is the naval battle, which is intense. And the second half is them being used as slave labor by the Japanese to build the Death Railroad. And it's brutal what happened to those sailors and how some of them were being moved on a Japanese transport ship and they were sunk by an American submarine, which is now a museum ship in San Francisco, the Pampanito. Mm-hmm. And the crew of the Pampanito was not happy that they torpedoed. They could not have known that they were going to torpedo a Japanese troop transport with a with U.S. and Australian POWs. But the commandant who was using all the POWs as slave labor gave a really horrific speech. You know, something along the lines of like, you are all dead and you're, you know, just truly evil. Well, one of the officers like wrote it down of like, this is what he said to us. And while that guy did not survive, his diary did. And that was used as evidence in the war crimes trial for the Japanese commandant and what, you know, how justice caught up with him. Because using human beings as slave labor, starving them to death, just truly horrific actions against humanity. A lot there. Yeah. And what we see, what happened to Echo, is kind of in that realm because they experimented on him. And you know, we do need to talk about collaboration, but you know, like my reaction of looking at the Uniform Code of Military Justice and how this again crosses over to things from the Geneva Convention because it's incorporates about a bunch of it. What a U.S. Soldier could get into trouble for as a war crime is cruel or inhuman treatment. And we'll talk about each of these. Let's go through the list. Performing biological experiments on POWs and mutilating or maiming. I think all of those were there with the treatment of Echo. And it's one thing to treat a POW, like say the downed pilot, you know, somebody who's gravely injured, like you provide medical care, but that doesn't mean you get to hook them up to the machine and suck information out of them and use them. So let's break that down with cruel or inhuman treatment. And, you know, could you break that down for us? And then let's get into the experimentation and mutilating.
Yeah, I mean, it's purposefully not complex language because the kinds of stories that you're telling here from the Civil War and whatnot, I mean, you know, these incidents that shock the conscience, they drove a desire to create sort of a clear-cut set of rules where there really isn't much gray area for folks to sort of misinterpret and say, well, you didn't say that I, you know, had to provide him medical care or this or that. You didn't say that I had to feed him three times a day. The idea was to set a set of clear framework, objectively acceptable framework that would ensure that the horrors that they've seen again and again and again would not happen again, or at least, you know, they would be mitigated to some degree. And so the overall umbrella that we're dealing with here is this idea of humane treatment. That includes basic hygiene standards, provision of infirmaries, the allowance of medical inspections, sufficient billeting, food, water, and clothing. There's a provision in there that they have to be allowed access to like a canteen. So think of like a prison store where they can purchase certain goods and whatnot. POWs have to be paid, believe it or not. The minimum is a quarter Swiss franc and that standard hasn't changed. I don't know what a quarter Swiss franc gets you these days. But the techno union has clearly looked at Echo, in probably the most subhuman way possible. They saw Echo, as a brain, a source of information, this algorithm that he and Rex had perfected. And they sought to tap that. And you saw Wat Tambor, the techno union head, sort of get into, he cut right down to the quick where he said exactly what their thinking was. This was a source of profit for the Techno Union. Presumably, even though they're a member of the separatist army, I presume they're selling access to this algorithm, or they're selling access to Echo's brain. I don't know how much the rest of the separatist army, like Admiral Trench, knew how they were getting this information. They just knew it was effective. And, you know, it's one of the, I almost looked at it, this is like a cruel, like awful way to think about it, but like every time Admiral Trench needs a strategy from the algorithm, it's like dialing up a 1-900 number back in the day, where they're 99 cents for the first minute and 59 cents for every minute of algorithm use after that for your battle strategies. But yeah, I mean, it just flies in the face of everything. He's maybe on some level, you could argue he's obviously being sustained with nutrients and whatnot in that suspended animation, but that's an awful mental hell to be toiling in. I mean, you know, you're allowed to be put to work as a POW. There are discipline and labor standards. But the, for NCOs, which Echo, I think, was presumably a non-commissioned officer, he can only be compelled to do supervisory work. So he can't be made to just work for work's sake. And if he's an officer, he can't be made to do any compulsory work. But even the work is restricted further, you know, based on that. You can't have any dangerous or unhealthy work. And more importantly, POWs can't be made to do work with a military character or purpose. So for example, a set of POWs couldn't be made to man like a dangerous artillery position or dig out, you know, a trench for enemy soldiers to use. That's exactly what Echo is being made to do here, being plugged in and made to feed battle strategies to the separatist army. So clearly the Techno Union is like way off the reservation in what they're doing with him.
Yeah, it's super evil. They refer to him as property at one point. Mm-hmm. And like not even by name, it's by property. And that's messed up. And yeah, their standing's weird because they also talk about having corporate neutrality or something along those lines, like playing the game of, yeah, we're not, yeah, we can do what we want because we're neutral, even though we're part of the separatists. And that's just weird. That's something we could discuss in detail at another time, because we do need to understand what exactly that would entail and how they're active within the separatist government. But let's get into the issue of maiming and mutilation, because, you know, Echo's cut up. And, you know, like the text says, the act of a person who intentionally injures or conspires or attempts to injure or injures with, whether intentionally or unintentionally in the course of committing any other offense under this subsection, one or more persons taking no active part in the hostilities, including those placed out of combat by sickness, wounds, detention, or other cause, by disfiguring the person or persons by any mutilation thereof, or by permanently disabling any member, limb, or organ of his body without any legitimate medical or dental purpose. They have electrodes in his head. He's wired to a machine.
And looks like Neo out of the Matrix.
Yeah, and it's not life-sustaining. It's they're pumping information out of him. That's mutilation. There's, you know, it's also could be considered a biological experiment as well. But what they're doing, you know, is just messed up on so many levels. Now let's pivot to something lighter, and that's the rescue of POWs. Now, is there, you know, the mindset we don't leave anyone behind? But we don't want to lose like 10 guys trying to save one. So like, what do we, you know, is there a duty to rescue a POW?
No. And in fact, you know, it's going to be mission dependent. I will tell you that in cases where we've had a POW, every possible resource is dedicated where it can be. So I go back to my own time in Afghanistan. I can think of one instance where there was a report that a soldier had been, taken captive following a skirmish. And the level of resources that were dedicated to trying to track that soldier down and really prevent a POW situation there was tremendous. I mean, it was a virtual reprogramming of all assets that we had on hand, air, ground, and otherwise. But on the flip side of things, if you guys listening have heard of the case of Bo Bergdahl, the longtime POW who was released as part of a deal with the Taliban. Oh gosh, what was that? 2015, something along that, 2015, 2016. It's very different. I mean, anytime there was a credible lead about where Sergeant Bergdahl might have been, forces were surged to try to follow up on that lead and run it to ground. But the bulk of the service and the bulk of the war effort wasn't dedicated at all points in time to trying to rescue him, operations weren't running around the clock to search places and kick in doors or anything like that. It was that's just not the reality of the situation. He was still a top priority. I remember we'd get reminders on a daily basis that any information leading to his whereabouts was critical because he was the only POW at the time that U.S. forces had out there. So it was a top priority, but it wasn't one that actively diverted resources every day.
Yeah. And, again, there's the growing up in the 80s, there were lots of movies about going back to save the POWs in Vietnam, because that was a thing. And yeah, so again, it's a popular concept of we go get our people.
Well, think about John McCain. I mean, mm-hmm. he was in prison for, we knew exactly, more or less where he was, but the reality of the situation was that while, his repatriation was a priority as well as like his fellow POWs, the realities of the warfare were just such that it didn't happen in any amount of short, in any kind of short period of time. I mean, he was there for years.
Yeah, 5.5. And yeah. Admiral Stockdale, 7. Jeremiah Denton, also up there. And, Denton's book is named When Hell Was in Session. And to read it, you understand what hell was for those men. And John McCain's book also goes into it. I got for Christmas, haven't had a chance to read it, about those in the Hanoi Hilton and developing the TAP code.
Mm-hmm.
And just work's been crazy, but there's going to be free time soon. And I do want to read that, because what those guys were all heroes. Many of my heroes are guys who were shot down, and they didn't break, and they held their own. So God bless each and every one of them. But we couldn't go into downtown Hanoi and rescue those guys. We know McCain's father would have loved a mission like that, mm-hmm. but it's downtown Hanoi. It's not possible.
Yeah.
A rescue mission in downtown Berlin during World War II. Yeah, that would have been fun, but you can't do that.
When it would be really tough to craft to put that sort of legal burden on a military commander, because the realities of the circumstances are often such that you don't have that option. I mean, if, take a commander in Afghanistan right now, if an American soldier were taken and taken across the border to Pakistan, to Lahore and you have a legal obligation to rescue that soldier, like an affirmative duty, are you going to breach Pakistan's sovereignty to go after that soldier? Like at what level? And you know, are you going to be the commander that risks your own, future and put yourself in legal jeopardy to buck that? It would create a really tough circumstance, not to mention the negative effects on what the mission is. Because, if that rescue mission might divert forces from some other really critical task, whether that's fighting the enemy or something else. Not that you don't want to go after the POW, but the realities of conflict are often, a little muddy.
Yeah. I'd prefer the commander in chief go like, no, go get our people. it's just, you have my blessing. Get them home. Presuming there aren't other fronts going on. Now we do get Echo repatriated, he's rescued. But would somebody who's a POW be put back into service that quickly? Like flying missions and, this is a full-on ground assault into a capital ship to, do basically a spy mission. It's a cartoon. It's a damn good cartoon. But do we put people back onto the front line that quickly?
Well, interestingly, and we don't know, you brought up his many injuries. We don't know how many of those he sustained at the Citadel or how many of those were inflicted upon him later. But actually, Article 109 of the Geneva Conventions, the Third Geneva Convention, requires that seriously sick and wounded POWs be repatriated before the hostilities end, which is interesting. So it's an affirmative duty to turn those folks over rather than keep them held. And that includes the incurably sick and wounded as well as the permanently disabled. So they definitely should have repatriated him before, but obviously they had a more profitable use for him. It depends on, to your question, I think it depends on him. I think there would be a process, a really lengthy process that he would have to go through. But I think, in what's it been, like 19 years of war, as crazy as that is, we've seen some incredible stories of soldiers that are seriously wounded and go right back into action. I mean, I represented a soldier that was seriously hurt in an IED explosion and then and got a Purple Heart for that. The next week, he was back out in a convoy in a Humvee, which hit another IED. It wasn't the same Humvee, obviously, but he was hit by a second IED and got a Purple Heart again. And then he came back into service after months and months of rehab from that injury. You see soldiers on active duty right now, not a ton of them, but some that have lost limbs and have overcome that sort of thing and continue to serve to this day. So I think it's really dependent on who the soldier is. Echo is sort of in a unique position because they really needed him. So I think Republic Command was probably willing to make an exception, send him to the doctor later.
Yeah, you good? Yeah, I'm good. All right, let's go.
Just shake it off real quick.
We're gonna need you to walk this off. Did you notice I have robot legs? I'm a little upset about this.
Well, he went really quickly from like he can't walk on his own, and Wrecker, I think it was, carried him out of the facility to like full on hit. Here's your newly upgraded armor, and let's go. We got a war to win.
Yeah, maybe he was fed and, the bionic parts recharged and
yeah,
all that good stuff.
I don't need to eat normally. Just plug in that MRE into that slot right there on my side.
it does raise a question. And again, it would be canon breaking. So, people lose limbs from lightsabers and they get a robot arm. Like that's what happens. We've seen that a while. It's like, could you clone like new parts for people?
Mm.
And like looking at a clone whose most of his body is blown to hell, like could they grow him, you know, the missing parts and rebuild them that way?
That's a good question. Yeah, I don't know. There was a fascinating bit in the book, A New Dawn, which was one of the first, I think it was the first one in the new canon, about Kanan meeting Hera for the first time and sort of their first adventure together. And there was a character in there named Skelly, who was a Clone Wars veteran. He was not a clone, but he had lost a limb in the war. And one of his sort of eternal frustrations was that the, you know, Imperial Department of Veterans Affairs, for lack of a better term, like the VA for the Empire, gave him like a really crummy replacement arm, and that was it. So it was kind of constantly malfunctioning and stuff. But it was one of the, it almost became like a part of his character, because it was just this lingering reminder of the war that he dealt with. So I don't know, that the Kaminoans are up to some shady stuff. So I wouldn't be surprised if they had like a limb farm somewhere on Geno or on Kamino there.
Yeah, it's, you know, the fact that they're all clones, I mean, that could get rid of some of the issues with making the growing a replacement limb for someone.
Yeah.
And Echo would need more than, you know, a limb. He would need basically at least a lung. Everything else.
It's like when you have to drop your car off at the shop for like a few days. Like he's going to be in for a while.
Yeah, he needs lots of work done. So this is, it's a really big Bantha tank to like connect the parts and hope everything takes. Yeah, because he wouldn't be able to live probably without the bionic parts. I don't know if the heart's there, but I mean, there's less of him than Maul. like it's like, and that's a big standard right there. Now we do have, you know, like moving on, we have Anakin getting rougher and clearly showing some dark side tendencies when he confronts Admiral Trench to get the bomb code. So we do have the ticking nuclear bomb, and that's important for the enhanced interrogation discussion that happens here. But we have Anakin, when Trench taunts him, Anakin cuts off Trench's mechanical arms, like three of them with one blow, and it's his left side, to show like, no, I am serious. You're going to give me that code. And
it's like a really good, not a callback, but in a way, a callback to Revenge of the Sith, or maybe a good bit of foreshadowing with cutting off Dooku's hands. That's just what instantly jumped to my mind.
He develops a propensity for disarming people.
Yeah, literally. Limbs are given no respect in the Star Wars galaxy. It's just, they're just completely disposable. Just chop them off left and right.
In one of the Vader comics, he's, you know, hacking off limbs for Inquisitors. And like during a training session, it's like, well, it's just a limb. It's like, okay, buddy, that's a, you're a horrible manager. So, like, but now he does that to get the ticking bombs code to defuse it for Mace Windu. You know, like we don't like torture. You know, we do discuss the idea that, you know, the ticking bomb situation could be a reason to like break somebody's arm in order to get the code. And Trench does give it up. But like, what was your reaction to Anakin getting a little enhanced?
He jumped right to it. I mean, I get the urgency because that bomb would have wiped out apparently enough Republic soldiers that it would have turned the tide for the entire war, which is obviously a concern. I don't know. I hated Trench since the first season, where you have that the invisible or the stealth ship episode, where he's playing, or that, excuse me, the episode itself is called Cat and Mouse, where Anakin's on that stealth ship and he ends up duping Trench. So I was happy to see him bring Trench down a peg. He's like the most arrogant general that they have. I guess I was a little bit less concerned just because they're clearly robotic arms, I suppose. So I'm like, you know, it's sort of like chopping off an arm of General Grievous. But I was more concerned with Anakin as a character because he's not that we don't know where he's going, but you clearly see him stepping just knee deep into the dark side of things. You know, that rage is just showing right through. I mean, he had no patience whatsoever for Trench's games.
Yeah, it is concerning. I mean, like, he did kill women and children on Tatooine. So again, we know there's some anger management issues that should have been raised with Obi-Wan earlier. It does meet the test of there's a bomb and it's going to basically wipe out the planet.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like he wasn't like going for the legs or the natural arms. So, but he clearly was, meant to instill fears. I mean, like, it's a form of torture of, I will kill you, on principle and not the Jedi way. But clearly, I do think there's a justification argument, even if you don't like it. Now we do have, I do think Anakin kills Trench in self-defense because Trench tries using a weapon on him and it was resisting the weapon and like being electrocuted that Anakin stabs Trench.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think what Anakin did was in self-defense.
I thought, by the way, that moment where he gets electrocuted by Trench's staff and he just shakes it off and stabs him is like phenomenal. And it's, if you've read the original Darth Vader comic, the 25 issue run, there's a moment in issue, 24, 25, where the bad guy, so to speak, I hate to say, because Vader is a bad guy, but like the antagonist of the comic shuts down Vader's suit or attempts to do so by overriding all of its electrical components. And Vader like just wills himself back up. Like, and it was a direct parallel for that. I was just like, I nerded out a little bit, especially because I don't like Trench. So
he is a bad, bad arachnid. And yeah. I thought he had been killed, in that, cat and mouse episode.
Mm-hmm.
Because, hey,
his ship blew up. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, how'd he get out of that? Anyway, but yeah, they did take care of him.
I will say, I love his character. I love that he's a competent, like tactically brilliant general, but because of that, I don't like him at all. And he's arrogant. Yeah. So I don't like him.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, that was a nice, robust discussion of three episodes of The Clone Wars. And I appreciate everyone for tuning in. Check us out on Patreon, where we have some additional content. We are on many podcast platforms, whichever one you enjoy us on. Please leave a review. We do appreciate that immensely. And everyone, stay healthy. Really, really stay healthy. And stay geeky. Stay geeky, America.